Susan, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Because you're going to be introduced in about 5 seconds.
Yeah, I know. I'm off.
I'm ready.
Good evening. Welcome to the March 2015 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. The first order of business will be approval of the minutes of our last meeting. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? There being none, the minutes will stand as they have been sent out. The next item would be public comment. Is there anyone who would like to make a public comment on an item that is not on the agenda? Okay, there being none of those, I'm happy to introduce our program for this evening. Kathleen Carley, who's been before us many times and wears many hats, and tonight she's going to talk about outside and slow, and that we take our climate very seriously in terms of our health. So as soon as our technical requirements are up and running, we'll be on with the program. Looks good. Thank you, and welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you. I'm here today to talk about a different issue. You guys have heard me talk before about obesity prevention and healthy communities and smoking cessation. Today I'm here to talk about climate change. And about 5 years ago, this started with a conference that Dr. Bornstein was not able to attend. And she asked me if I'd like to go. And when she asked me if I wanted to go, I thought, yeah, that sounds great. I really didn't see that there was any relationship between going to this conference and my job at that point. I mean, I believe in climate change. I drive a hybrid vehicle. I recycle. I mean, you know, I saw Inconvenient Truth with everybody else at the Palm and have to admit I fell asleep because it was all those slides. It was just like, it wasn't an action flick, you know. So I believed in it in my personal life, but I did not see a connection between climate change and my job. And so, you know, a lot of times you go to these conferences and you come out and you think, oh, that was good. Well, this one I came out and I was a convert. And I saw a direct relationship between climate change and the work that I do. And so I came back and I started doing some talks in the community. And I've actually been talking at a graduate class at Cal Poly for about the past 5 years. And last year, the professor came to me and said, as a result of my talk, there was one student in the class that completely changed their major, and they were sold on public health, and this is the work that they wanted to do. And things like that, I mean, you feel so good, you know. It's one person at a time, but I felt like I made a difference. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit today about climate change and hopefully convert you if you don't believe that it's a public health issue, and then talk about a project that we've been working on for about the past year with the California Department of Public Health. So let's see if it works. Jean, you better advance. So this was an article that Dr. Margaret Chan published this year, and she basically said, for public health, climate change is a defining issue of the 21st century. Now, I know I've come to you before and said obesity is the defining issue of the 21st century, and we have not solved the obesity crisis. It's still a huge issue. But climate change has the ability to affect the food we eat, the water we drink, and the chances that the people we serve will be infected with a life-threatening infectious disease. It's a huge issue. Next. This is Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association, and he said that climate change is one of the most serious public health threats facing our nation, yet few Americans are aware of the consequences of climate change on the health of our communities, our families, and our children. Now, you know, when it first started, we used the term global warming. My father, who passed away recently, was very conservative, and I remember he called me 1 year from Idaho where he lived, and he said, you know, global warming, he goes, it's not real. Do you know how much snow we have outside? So global warming is not real. And so the term global warming is falling out of favor. Nowadays we use the term climate change. because our climate is heating. That is the truth. But it's causing different weather patterns. And cold, the polar vortex, which occurred along the eastern seaboard, is a direct result of climate change. And so the term that we use nowadays is climate change. And of course, it also impacts hurricanes, heat waves, drought, flooding. I was fortunate enough to go to Cuba about 4 years ago and study climate change in Cuba. And in Cuba, climate change is something no one doubts it. And it's because Cuba is on the path of all of the hurricanes that go up the eastern seaboard. And from 1960 to 2000, there were 10 major hurricanes that hit Cuba. From 2001 to 2011, there were 16 major hurricanes, almost five times as many. And so the people in Cuba, cambio climático is something that everybody accepts. And they start teaching kids when they're in third, when they're about 3-4 years old about climate change. And they actually teach them CPR when they get to be in kindergarten. And that's because their parents or their grandparents may be the victim of one of these hurricanes, and everyone needs to know how to react in those situations. The workshop I went to was started this whole process was taught by a man named Ed Maybach. And Ed Maybach is at George Mason University in D.C., and he and his researchers, his colleagues, went out to the Washington Mall and they interviewed people. And they basically said that there are six distinct viewpoints about climate change in United States. And they actually did the first survey in 2010, and then it changed in 2012, and they've updated these numbers. And basically, it goes from people who are alarmed. They have the highest belief in climate change, and they're the ones that are advocating, writing letters, doing everything possible to fight this. And then you've got people on the complete other end of the spectrum, and those are dismissive. And it doesn't matter what you say to those people are never going to believe anything you present. It doesn't matter what facts you use, they're never going to believe you. And most of us fall somewhere in that continuum. The group that I think is really interesting is the disengaged group in the center, and that group represents low income, people of low socioeconomic status. And basically what Dr. Maybach explained was, if you think about Maslow's hierarchy that we all learned in school, people on the lowest rung are just dealing with survival. And then you cannot really deal with self-actualization until you get to the higher rungs, until you've got survival met. And so people that are struggling with food and a place to live, shelter, they really don't have time to think about climate change. They're just trying to find enough food to feed their children at the next meal. And what Dr. Maybach said is that group is the group that's most disproportionately impacted by climate change. And if you can get that group stable, they can be your biggest advocates. And I'm going to share some information with you in a little bit about something we did with our WIC clients. And that kind of proves to be true. A lot of times we think if you read the newspaper or watch some of the news shows on TV, that we really have a 50-50 split in our country. 50% of the people believe in climate change and 50% of the people don't. But that's not really true. This is a poll that was done by the Public Policy Institute in 2013. And basically what this shows is that a record number of Californians say the state needs to do something to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. You've got about 80%, and that was 2013. I would be willing to bet after the drought and the heat that we've experienced in the past couple of years that is probably even a little higher. Keep in mind that California leads the pack. California is one of the leaders in the nation for the things that we've done on climate change. Our last two governors, coming from different political parties, I know Governor Brown's been in a couple terms, but even Governor Schwarzenegger before him, Governor Schwarzenegger took a lot of steps on climate change, and this is not a political issue. It's an issue of science, and for us, it's a public health issue. So we have to decide what makes people care. You know, how, if I'm in that continuum, and maybe I believe it, but I'm not doing much, what's going to push me over the edge to make me somebody who's more active? And really, the key is, I've got to believe that humans caused it, and I've got to believe that there's something I can do. If you think that there's nothing that you can do about it, it's there, it's going to happen, and you, what you do doesn't make a difference, then you're going to tune out. So what we've got to do is educate people and tell them what they can do. It's not about what you can't do, it's about what you can do. And everything we do collectively can make a difference, but it's got to be a collective effort by all of us. So I remember sitting there 5 years ago and thinking, you know, how am I ever going to explain this? I'm not a climatologist. I can't go explain what's going on. I don't even think I could have explained what greenhouse gas emissions were at that time. So I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, I can tell you a lot of stuff about tobacco. I can tell you a lot of stuff about obesity, but how am I going to tell you climate change? And Dr. Maybach said that we need to explain it in terms of our knowledge base. We need to use our knowledge base. And he said, we know that this is a fact, 97% of the world's most qualified experts agree climate change is real. That's a fact. And he said, if people come to you and they question why you're doing what you're doing, ask them, if 97% of the world's most qualified pediatricians said your child was ill, would you follow the pediatrician's advice, or would you go try and find the 3% of doctors that said that they were fine? And we all know what we would do. We would follow the experts, and we need to follow the experts on this topic as well. It's based in science. This is not anecdotal evidence. This is fact. So the International Panel on Climate Change, this was a statement they made in 2007. They've convened several times since then. But basically what they said, the warming of our climate is unequivocal. And you can look at, heat records from NASA, from IPCC. You can look at everybody's heat records and see that heat records have been broken over and over again. This is, I pulled this out in 2013. These were 2013 headlines. And you can see Australia, Alaska, Minnesota, Europe and Asia. I mean, everywhere you go, heat records continue to be broken. John Lindsay in the Tribune last year in September said 2014 is on track to be the warmest year in California. But in 2013, they said it was the warmest year in California. And in 2012, they said it was the warmest year. We continue to climb, and we continue to break heat records on a monthly basis all over the world. The greenhouse effect, I did the talk at Cal Poly again about a week ago, and the way I've learned to explain it is I asked students, have you ever been in a greenhouse? And they raised their hands, and I said, what's it feel like in a greenhouse? And they said, muggy, it's humid. Well, that's what's happening to our planet. And what ends up happening is the sunlight comes down, and it bounces back. But instead of escaping into the atmosphere, the greenhouse gases are trapping the heat in the atmosphere and making it hotter. And then as it gets hotter, you get more moisture in the atmosphere. And as you get more moisture, it makes the temperature go up. And it's almost like a feedback loop. I've lived in San Luis Obispo since early 1980s. And I remember when I moved to Los Osos, everybody goes, oh, don't move to Los Osos. It's always foggy out there. It's always foggy and cold out there. I'll tell you something. It's not foggy and cold anymore. You guys, I'm in the place to be. You know, it's sunny and it's even getting humid out there. And so, anecdotally, we see that there are changes going on, but scientifically, we can prove it. Now, the interesting thing is that this is a map, and you can see that the United States is bloated, and some of the more developing countries are very narrow and shrunken. And so everybody, every country in the world contributes greenhouse gas emissions, but the United States contributes the most per capita. Now, one of the arguments that's given is that China contributes more greenhouse gases than the United States. And I think it's the next slide, if I left it in there. Yes. And they do, China is about 10 billion tons, and the U.S. is about 5.9 billion tons. But I want you to think about population of these two countries. China has four times as many people as the United States does. So per capita, no one in the world contributes as much as people in the United States. And it's not just from the cars that we drive. We're a consumer society. Everything we buy, every time you go to a dollar store and you buy this junk and you walk out of the store and you think, why did I buy that? We're contributing to greenhouse gas emissions because our consumer, need to buy this thing that's only a dollar creates people who make more dollar things for us. And so we're a consumer society and we continue to push out this greenhouse gas. If you look here, that's 2012 data up there, but if you look in 2013, it only went up 2.3% as far as total emissions. And that doesn't look that bad, but if you figure every year it's going up 2.3%, it's significant. We need to start decreasing, not continuing to increase. And the problem is, as the rest of the world becomes more affluent, they start contributing more greenhouse gas emissions because they want the same stuff we do. I remember when I was in Cuba, the disenfranchised in Cuba are the young people, the 20 and 30-year-olds, and they're very unhappy with what's going on in their society. The people my age, they still remember the revolution like it happened yesterday, and they're still ready to put up the power fist for Castro. But the younger people, they all want to leave. And you know why they want to leave? Because they want iPods and iPhones and iPads and high-heeled shoes. And they want all of the symbols of affluence that the United States has. And so this is a problem. We've got to get a handle on it. There's a term, when I first learned this, I they weren't using the term climate gap, but it's become very popular to use now. Because basically what we're saying is people of color and the poor will suffer disproportionately from the impacts of climate change. One example that I can give, I remember reading an article in the Tribune this past summer, and the article was about the drought and how food prices were going to go up. And the point of the article was food prices are going to go up, but it's not going to be a big deal because they're only going to go up 5%. And I remember thinking, they're not a big deal. If 5% is not a big deal for me. I can afford 5% increase in food. But when you're on a fixed income and you make $800 a month, like a lot of our seniors or our disabled population does, if you're a farm worker and you're paid $10 an hour, that's your hourly wage, 5% is huge. The people that have experienced reduced economic opportunities are the farm workers. The green belt that goes all the way through, the breadbasket of our nation in the Central Valley, there were not many jobs there this summer. And so migrant farm workers were desperately trying to find place to work. And then the spending gap and also higher air pollution levels. They do not build factories that put out toxic fumes in upscale neighborhoods. They put them in neighborhoods where people don't have a lot of power. And so they're the ones that have the higher air pollution. They're paying more, and they have less opportunities. This is another map. You see up in the corner, the top left corner, is the carbon emission one that I showed you before. And then the other three maps show you around the world where people are already being killed by climate change. And you can see drought really is, India, China, less developed countries, Pakistan, killed by storms. Again, you can see we have a few people that die from storms in the United States, but it's really developing countries. and then killed by floods. Same thing. We have infrastructure here. And, you know, we have Hurricane Katrina. We have Superstorm Sandy, and it's terrible, no doubt about it. But we have first responders. Our buildings, don't all collapse on the first side of a storm. And so even though we have deaths, you know, our population is doing much better than population from other parts of the world. This is a slide from CDC, and it's pretty cool. I just got it. But basically what you can see in the center are the impacts of climate change. And then the first circle out is what's being caused as a result of that. And then at the edge of the circle are all of the health issues that are caused by these things like allergens and vector ecology and air pollution, et cetera. I'm going to go over a few of them briefly, but I think it's great. And we were at Farmers Market on Thursday, and there was a medical student that's doing an internship in our public health department, and he goes, I don't even think they're all on there. He goes, and he starts rattling off more health impacts that he thought, you know, also should be on that slide. So heat stress is obvious. Who is impacted by heat stress? The young and the elderly. In France in 2003, there was a heat wave, and there was 34,000 people that died in France alone. And, where these people are dying, they're not dying in the countryside. What I want you to think about is an urban center and some of the old housing that's been around for a long time. And a lot of senior citizens are in, you know, what they call single-room occupancy or, you know, hotels that are multi-level, small rooms. There's no air conditioning in these rooms. Some of these housing arrangements are in communities where crime may be an issue. So the senior is afraid to come out of their house. So it gets really hot. They're in this old substandard housing often. They lock themselves in because they're afraid to go out, and they literally bake to death. it's really terrifying. What is heat stress? It's 3 straight days with no cooling at night. You know, sometimes, if you get a cool breeze at night, your body can recover, and then, you know, the next day it's hot again. You can deal with that. But when it goes on and there is no cooling, you know, that's where there's a problem. You know, it was interesting when we were in China, there was many doctors on the tour with me, and they were quizzing, because we were in Cuba, and it was October, and it was about 105 with about 98% humidity. It was awful. And so the doctors are talking to the Cuban doctors, and they're asking about heat stress and about heart attacks when it's hot. And the Cuban doctors kept saying, no, we don't have any problems when it's hot. And so the American doctors couldn't figure out why. And finally somebody said, well, you know, the Cuban doctor says it's worse for us when it cools down. So the American doctors finally said, well, how are you defining cool down? And they said, well, cool down for us is about 90, 95 degrees. So basically the people were used to dealing with this awful, and when it cooled down a little bit is when they were rushed to the hospital. And it was interesting because in Cuba there's a seawall that goes all along Havana and along the ocean in Havana. And at 11, 12 o'clock at night, the families would be out on the seawall because they lived in housing with no air conditioning, and so that was the only cool place for them to be. So they sat out on the seawall, and they brought their musical instruments, and the kids brought toys, and they played out there till it cooled down enough for them to go inside their houses, which I thought was pretty interesting. This is a study that was done by the National Natural Resources Defense Council in 2008, and it was based on a 2006 California heat wave. Keep in mind these studies usually take several years because you got to collect all the data from the hospitals, and that takes time. So I'm sure we'll have more studies like that after the last summer we had in 2014. But here they just found that basically emergency department visits skyrocketed during that time. And you can see San Francisco, 23-fold increase in emergency department visits. Los Angeles, 5,500 additional emergency department visits. They increased sevenfold in the Central Valley. And they estimated $133 million in health-related costs just for that one heat wave period. And so our hospitals and our emergency rooms are going to be flooded with people going there unless we do something about this and we can start decreasing some of these impacts. Another thing that happens is injuries and fatalities. That's pretty obvious. You know, it's not only the people that were killed by Hurricane Katrina, but the people that became ill after, which was actually 7,500 were injured or became ill after the hurricane ended. In Superstorm Sandy, you know, only 117 people died, which is a miracle. But the damage to those communities, and they still haven't recovered, is like $62 billion. And then, you know, fire, there's deaths and fires. And our wildfire season, I think an interesting statistic is in 2014, this past year, California exhausted its firefighting budget before wildfire season began. And so it's the injuries that happen as a result of all of these incidents. The other thing that happens is poor air quality. 91% of Californians live in areas with failing air quality grade. And it's the concentration of these facilities that give out these emissions. And we know that people of color and people living in poverty are disproportionately, you know, near these facilities. And there is something called cap and trade, and I don't know if you've heard it, and I probably wouldn't be the best person to explain it completely, but basically companies can get a tax break if they can reduce some of their pollution, is basically the simple idea. The problem is that they can reduce their pollution, but there's nothing in the legislation that mandates them to put these cleaner facilities in poor areas. So many times they place the cleaner facilities in areas where there's more affluent people who would complain if they had a bad facility in their neighborhood. So it's a great thing. Cap and trade is good, don't get me wrong, but some argue that we need to make sure that poor neighborhoods also receive the benefits. The other thing is allergies, and I've been sniffling all day. Everyone in my office, I had people that go home because of allergies today. I love this article in Chest, and they said the pollen explosion is a health threat no less consequential than cigarette smoking. Basically, what they're saying is as our season of heat lengthens up in Canada, the pollen season increased by almost a month. So as the pollen season increases because it's warmer outside, right, we get this allergy season that's much more difficult to treat. And there is something they call super pollens. Studies have shown that plants treated with CO2, so plants along a freeway or by a facility that's emitting these greenhouse gases, become much more difficult for allergists to treat. So your Claritin doesn't work as effectively anymore. Vector-borne disease, as we have increases in heat, precipitation, and humidity, insects that never used to be able to live where we're at can now live there. And so dengue fever, I can remember when I was a kid, dengue fever I think was something in a Spencer Tracy movie along the Amazon River. And now dengue fever is found in 28 states. We know Lyme disease has exploded. Maine has 10 times more cases than it did a decade ago. And West Nile virus, I'm sure you got the report from Dr. Bornstein when we had our first positive case and slow in a horse in September 2014. But it's all around us as far as other counties. Waterborne disease, one of the researchers I was with in Cuba was up in Seattle area, and his study was really on waterborne disease, and he was predicting a lot more deaths due to waterborne disease. First of all, in the developing world, they don't have water systems like we do that purify the water, but in our country, our water systems are designed to purify water when they have an optimal amount of water in their system. So when you have a drought and the amount of water decreases significantly, it's much more difficult to purify the water than it was when you had optimal. Same thing happens in a flood. When the system has too much water in it, it doesn't purify as well. So this researcher was postulating that there'd be a lot more waterborne disease and death as a result of drought. One thing people don't think about is mental health issues. First of all, if you survive Superstorm Sandy, I mean, think about what you had to go through. Or a major drought can lead to an epidemic of anxiety. There's a strong relationship between suicides and heat waves. If you're that senior in that apartment and is now 110 and you're afraid to go outside, think about the despair you must feel. There's the impact of major disasters on those who have to cope with them. How many times can a first responder deal with a major issue before it starts impacting them? And we know that mental health issues often go untreated, and people are going to be dealing with these symptoms for a long period of time. And then the thing that I had never thought of before was civil conflict. A lot of experts feel that the conflict in Darfur and Sudan was actually triggered by climate change. And basically what there's two groups of people that live in Darfur. There was the nomads, and they call them the Arabs, and there was the farmers, and they called them the Africans. And these two groups, there was always some conflict between them, but they lived relatively peacefully until a major drought occurred. And when the drought occurred, it triggered the civil conflict. Now, I am not suggesting by any means that we're going to have a civil conflict in Paso Robles, you know? But I want you to think about what's going on in Paso Robles. And you've got these long-term ranchers that have lived here forever, and they're having to sell off their herds because there's not enough feed. And then you've got families that are being told they have to drill down and pay, you know, $30,000 to go down a couple hundred feet to get a new well. And that's if they're lucky enough to get someone to do it. I've heard that there was a waiting list last summer of about 9 months to just get a well drilled on your property. And then you've got these new entrepreneurs that are coming in and putting millions of dollars into their vineyards and their wineries. And they have a legitimate issue, too. This is a financial, situation for them. And so we are a civilized society. We're not going to break down into civil conflict. But you can see that the issues that are raised bring strong reactions. And when you live in a less civilized society, a developing country, you know, there's many people that predict that civil conflict, that water will be the new oil and people will be fighting over water. It's important to frame the issue properly, and that's why Dr. Maybach actually did this workshop that I went to 5 years ago, because a lot of people, you know, we all know that the polar bear. If I, you know, I had you close your eyes and put an image in your mind of climate change, we'd all see that polar bear sitting on the ice floe in the middle of the water all by himself, right? Well, a lot of people like polar bears and think they're cute, but they don't really, it doesn't impact their gut. And so what we need to do is we need to frame this issue as a health issue. We need to show that the impacts ultimately are on humans. And if we can frame it as a public health issue, we can perhaps get more people to join our collective effort. You've probably heard the terms adaptation and mitigation. They're both important. Adaptation is, how do I deal with this increased heat? You know, what do I do? And mitigation is, how do we stop some of these greenhouse gas emissions? How do we, you know, decrease maybe our consumer society reliance on buying things? And both of these issues are important. This is a pretty famous cartoon from 2009. And I love it because basically, what if it's a big hoax and we create a better world for nothing? You know, what we're advocating as far as climate change and some of the things we're working with some of our clients, it's not, we're not saying anything bad. We're saying good things. Next slide. And I'm not going to go through all of this, but basically, you know, one of the things we're talking about is the importance of a local sustainable food system. And it's not just, you know, us in San Luis Obispo that's focusing on local food. You know, several years ago, we had a buy local ordinance that went before the Board of Supervisors, and one of the growers we met with was from Povey, which is in South County, a large grower that ships all over the world. And when we were talking to them about our buy local ordinance, one of the directors of the company said that they're faced with that. When they're trying to sell their product now on the East Coast, they're getting a lot of pushback because people want to buy local there as well. So this buy local movement is all over. And it's really, you know, how to be sustainable, how to use what's in our community. The other thing we're focusing on is transportation. You know, walking when you can, riding your bike when you can, using public transportation when you can, driving, you know, fuel-efficient vehicles. And again, if, you know, more people, you know, took a few bike trips instead of driving, you know, 5 minutes in their car, we'd also have some health benefits, you know, decrease in traffic injuries, heart disease, depression, osteoporosis, you know, our obesity crisis, you know, would be helped. So it's a good thing that we're advocating. And then heat adaptation co-benefits, again, I you guys can keep this and review it, but we're just talking about basically a greener, you know, world, urban greening, reduced heat island effect, less concrete, reducing air pollution, et cetera. Now, about a year ago, the people who put on this workshop that I attended 5 years ago were from the California Department of Public Health, and I started to know them at the state level, and they knew I was doing my little talks, and I, you know, attended webinars, and they came to me and they said, you know, we would like to do a pilot project with you on climate change messaging. And they said, we don't have a lot of money, and it's going to take a lot of work. Do you want to do it? And we went, sure, you know, we like a lot of work, you know, we're used to working with not very much money. And so I spoke with Dr. Bornstein, and we got a committee together, and we started meeting about a year ago, and we came up with a logo and a tagline, Outside In Slow, We Take Health and Climate Change Personally. And we have community partners that we've been working with. And next slide. One of the things we decided to do, Linda McClure, who runs our WIC clinics, was, you know, very enthusiastic. And she said, you know, the clients who attend WIC, first of all, they're required to have, you know, education every 3 months. They're required to take a group class. And they're the ones that are going to be the most impacted by climate change. Maybe we could put together a little class for them and try and educate some of our WIC families. So we put together a curriculum, and you can see we spent the first 3 minutes talking about the difference between weather and climate. You know, weather is what's happening today. Climate is a pattern over time. Then we talked about the potential impacts in San Luis Obispo. You know, only 5 minutes, so we didn't spend a lot of time, but we talked about increased temperature, extreme storms, wildfire, rising sea level, decreased air quality, and drought. And we asked them if they'd experienced any of these things, what they knew about it, and so we spent a little bit of time on that. Then we said, now what can you do about it? Because remember what I said at the beginning, we've got to let people feel that they can make a difference. So we talked about transportation, walking or biking instead of driving, taking public transportation. We brought in bus maps for them. You know, but many of our WIC families are used to doing this anyway because most of these families only have one car per household. They don't have two cars. So many of the moms and their children, they take a bus when they come to us, or they carpool. They get several families together and come. So transportation was a pretty easy one. Then we talked in their home, what could they do? Reduce energy use, you know, plant drought-resistant landscaping. We talked about washing their clothes in cold water, shorter showers. And we talked to them about local food. And we put together this handout. I didn't put it up on the PowerPoint because there's a lot on it. But we put together this handout on seasonal produce, and we talked to them, you know, when you go into the grocery store and you're going to buy fruits and vegetables for your family, did you know if you buy fruits and vegetables in season that they're going to be less expensive than fruits and vegetables that they're shipping from Chile or, you know, somewhere else in the world? So we talked to them about what local produce is. We talked to them about farmers markets. And mentioned sometimes farmers markets are more expensive. However, if you buy, you know, if you buy Sea Canyon apples during apple season, you can get them for a really good deal. Don't go to the grocery store, buy Sea Canyon apples because you can get them for a really great buy. And then the other thing we did, which was, I think, a great idea, you know, was collaborating with Glean Slow. I don't know how many of you know, but Glean Slow is a program through the food bank, and Glean Slow was trying to get more low-income people to help glean. And so gleaning, they go to the farms where the farmers already picked everything they want, and then the gleaners pick it, and they give it to the food bank for distribution. And so we recruited a lot of our families from WIC to participate in gleaning, and then as a result of helping glean, they got a bag of fresh produce. So that was one of the things we focused on. And then the other thing we focused on was tap water. And I've got one last handout. Many of our families come from Mexico or Central or South America, and where they live, they're, you know, tap water is not safe. So when they come, you know, we'd see a lot of them coming into the WIC clinics with these single, you know, use bottles of water that they've bought at the store. And so Wendy Furtschneider, one of our dietitians in WIC, did a cost analysis, which I think was just brilliant. And she basically, you know, figured out that the average person drinks 20 gallons of water a month. I don't know where she got that from. But then she did a cost analysis. If you drink tap water, this 20 gallons per month for a year will cost you $2.78. If, however, you buy single-serve bottles and you buy it one bottle at a time, that same water will cost you $1,988.26. So our families could not believe it. Now, even if they buy the water in cases, they buy a 24 case of water, it's still all $424, right? Oh, I didn't give you guys any here. Sorry. I'll bring them. So I just thought it was a great analysis. And then what we did, next slide, is after we told them what they could do, then we asked them to choose something. We want you to choose something that you're willing to do. And we are analyzing this through the California Department of Public Health. Just so you know, we reached 1,200 WIC families through this project. It was a two-month project, December and January. We reached 1,200 WIC families, and we asked them when they came in. Some of them had group education, some had individual education. We asked them when they came in, first of all, do you think climate change is an issue? And then we asked them the same question after, and we actually saw the biggest increase in the white population, not in the Hispanic population. On a 5-point scale, the Hispanic population, when we said, do you think climate change is an issue, they rated it 4.4. After the education, they went up to about 4.55. The white population that we did the same education with, they started out, they were, do you think climate change is an issue, they were about 3.8, and then they rose to about 4.5 after the education. So we saw an increase in both, but really our Hispanic population was much more, they seem to understand it more, and I think it's because they experience a lot of this stuff more. So far we've done the WIC collaboration, but we've done a lot of other things too. We've done 15 speaking or tabling events reaching over 600 people. We did the classes. We're collaborating with the Air Pollution Control District. They have a clean air ambassador program where they go into elementary schools and they educate people on clean air. We got them to include climate change in their curriculum. And, you know, we're going to wait till the end of the year and see how many kids that they've reached. We did a program at the Atascadero Library, and that was really interesting because the Atascadero Library on their own, right when we were starting, they were doing a program on climate change. And we contacted the librarian, and we collaborated with them. I went up, and it was funny, I did a talk at the library about this same talk I'm doing for you guys. John Lindsay did one the day before me, and I went and had to hear John Lindsay, right? So John Lindsay was there the day before me, and he had like 60 people at his talk. The next day I had like about five, and Jim Patterson was one of them, so he didn't count, really. You know? But... you know, and they did an art show in it at the Atascadero Library, and they had artists bring in their work, and there was a lot of polar bears on ice floes, but there was also some other interesting pieces. And we did bookmarks, and we did a bunch of things with them. We've had stories written in 7 media outlets, and if you didn't see New Times a couple weeks ago, we had a story, and that was a great piece. We had PSAs that have run over 2,000 times on local radio. We've bombarded every radio station that we can think of. We've done outreach at all of our farmers markets. We're still doing that through March. And then we're going to go back to the markets that were the most fruit, you know, that we gathered the most support and maybe do it again. And then we've had a strong social media campaign. We've had at least one mention on social media every week. And if you have not liked us on Facebook, that's our site, slowpublichealth.org, and I invite you to like us. We're always looking for more likes. This is Dr. James Hansen. He's well known. He's been arrested numerous times. I've seen him talk, you know, on videos before. He's a delightful man, and I will close with his quote. Ignorance is no excuse for us. There's overwhelming scientific evidence of global warming, its causes, and many of its implications. Today's generations will be accountable, and how tall we stand remains to be determined. There is still time, but just barely. When I think about this work, I'm doing this work for my children and for my grandchildren. They deserve to have a better world. So with that, if you have any questions, I'll try and answer them.
Thank you. That was really a great presentation, Kathleen. I think we all enjoyed it. Now, are there questions? And Commissioner Klaus?
Kathleen, that was a really good presentation. Thank you so much. As you pointed out, there's overwhelming scientific evidence that we need to do something with climate change. And certainly it looks like you guys are doing something locally, but it appears nationally that there's not a lot being done. It's always, well, the scientific evidence is there, but, you know, we're really, there's other people, because there's 110 inches of snow in Boston, then they'll think there's global warming. So what is it going to take nationally to get this going?
I don't even know how to answer that question. all I can do is focus on control. What I have control on, and so I do my best. I continue to hope that we will stop debating this. We're the only country in the world that debates whether climate change is real. You know, no other country is saying, well, maybe it's not real. You know. We need united action, and not just from the people on the side of the scale that tend to, you know, be in our corner. We need it from everyone. Again, I stress it's not a political issue. You know, this is not about whether you're a Democrat or an independent or a Republican or a member of the Tea Party. This is about science, and it's about the world that we are creating. And I just hope that enough people start feeling the way I feel.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions from commissioners? Go ahead, Commissioner Pope.
I don't have a question, but thank you very much for the subject matter that is dear to my heart. I spent 26 years as an environmental advisor, and basically was shot many times for the messages that I had to bring. But one of the things that I didn't hear mentioned was that we have the opportunity to make a choice to a more vegetarian diet, which will have a tremendous impact on global warming because of the fact that it takes so much of the vegetative material to make a pound of protein in an animal. And I have to, I'll bring up a company that I just frequented here the other day. Chipotle is giving you tofu as an option in their food, and it's quite tasty. So,
well, 30% of the greenhouse gases are caused by our industrial agricultural system. There are some people who advocate, you know, for a vegetarian diet. The problem is that becomes a huge issue with the meat industry, you know, and so we do not, you know, when we're educating people, we do not stress vegetarianism. But what we do stress is choosing meatless meals. You know, people can continue to eat meat, but if they just have one salad lunch a week, or, you know, choose three meals a week that don't have meat as their main course, that could make a difference. Both of my children are vegetarians. I am a closet meat eater. You know, when I cook at home, we don't cook any meat, especially if my kids are there. But there are times I go out for lunch and I have meat, and I try and do it sparingly, and I try and focus on a plant-based diet when I can. It was interesting. About a week ago, they were putting out, it was a nutrition advisory, and they said my plate's always been about, you know, what's good for you, and now they're going to start doing some of the, not only are grains and fruits and vegetables good for you because, you know, they have health benefits, but they're also better for the environment. So they're going to try and integrate some of those messages in with nutrition messages.
Go ahead, Commissioner Campbell.
I really thank you for this talk. I found it very affirming.
Thank you.
And I like the fact that there's so much focus on what can we do.
Right.
I was especially surprised and pleased to hear you talk about excess consumerism. And I appreciate that message is being at least discussed, at least brought out more into awareness, because I do believe that that is a huge negative effect, and that if we instead focus on needs versus wants and make them more local, that we can make a big difference. Thank you.
You know, I'll share a little anecdote with you. My son, who lives in Portland, and he's, you know, one of these hipsters that knows everything. So I was visiting him, and we were walking somewhere, and I said, it's just one of these little things that you talk with your kids about. I said, you know, I finally started flossing my teeth all the time. And he goes, how come? And I go, well, I'm using these floss picks, and they're so much better. I always would get the string caught in my teeth, but those floss picks are great. And my son looks at me, and he goes, oh, you're just filling the landfill with those things, aren't you? He goes, why can't you use regular floss like the rest of the world? So I've got this conscience, you know. I mean, even I've looked at him and I go, can't you just let me alone, you know, floss picks? Really? But, yeah, you're right. So, you know, at least he's thinking about things like that, you know.
Commissioner Campbell.
I'd like if you could expand on just one little detail. And that you mentioned the percent of Californians living with bad air quality or deteriorating air quality. Could you flesh that out a little?
No. Penny, can you flesh that a little?
No, not really.
I know.
91%. So there are six substances that are measured, ozone, CO2, particulate matter, nitrogen. I'm not, you know, if Larry Allen were here, he could
do it.
Toss them off, but yeah, so, and there are stationary air monitoring systems throughout the country as well as in California, and so I believe that that the 91% of Californians living with poor air quality means, I don't know exactly what it means, I'm guessing here, that there's some exceedances of the regulated acceptable levels of one or more of those air components at some point. But do not quote me on that.
All right.
I got that from the California Department of Public Health, that statistic. I could try and follow up and see if I could get some information to you.
That'd be great.
Sure. Yes?
Go ahead, Commissioner Pope.
Could I just add my own thought about the cost of real estate adjacent to all the freeway systems in California are going to be a little less costly, and people are going to gravitate, people of lower income are going to gravitate closer to a freeway, which is going to have far more pollutant influence. Same with being adjacent to most factories. That real estate prices are going to be less, and if I hope that hits along the subject that you were asking about.
We'll get back to you.
Commissioner Warren.
Thank you very much, Kathy.
Your microphone?
Presentation. Okay. Hello.
Yes, Jim.
Thank you for your presentation. Is it on still? Okay. Okay. Going back a little earlier in your presentation, when you talked about, I think that in Cuba, our southern states, I think where they were teaching the fourth graders how to do CPR.
That was in Cuba, actually.
Was that in Cuba?
Yep. No, at least not locally. We don't have anything. Keep in mind that our funding is, most all of my funding is grant directed, so it's not something that we have a grant to do. I think in like the Imperial Valley or something like that, where you get these temperatures that it's 120 degrees, I don't know if they're doing anything like that there, but I know in our county we're not at this time.
Go ahead, Ms. Warren, I'm sorry we couldn't hear.
So Commissioner Warren's concern was, are we educating
right.
Young people on recognizing heat stress and a heat stroke and what to do? As you said, the children in Cuba were learning.
Right.
And your answer was no.
Yeah.
But very good point. Very good point. Are there any other comments?
Thank you.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Are there any other comments or questions from the commissioners for our esteemed speaker? Well, thank you so much. That really was, I think everybody wants to give you a hand.
Oh, thank you.
We always love your presentations. This was outstanding. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Then we'll move on. For our public health report, Dr. Bornstein.
Good evening. I just have a very short report with a couple of announcements. The California Department of Public Health has a new director and state health officer. That might not mean a lot to people locally, but it means a lot to me because the director of the state public health department often sets the policy agenda for public health throughout our state. So I'm very pleased to say that for the third time in a row, a local public health officer, a county health officer, has been named to the state officer's state health officer position, and that's Karen Smith, who comes from Napa County. She has decades worth of public health experience and a master's in public health, and so I'm looking forward to working with her in that new capacity. Secondly, I wanted to announce that the CDC has just come out with a report that says that testing for tuberculosis is now can be done through what's called a nucleic acid amplification test, affectionately known as NAT. For decades and decades, it has always been based on looking at sputum under a slide and looking for a certain gram staining to acid fast bacilli. What's nice about that is we are getting the machine that can do the NAT testing in a way that makes it just as good as looking at the specimens under the microscope, and is a much more predictable, true answer as to whether or not you have tuberculosis or not. So typically now we do the smears. They're somewhat meaningless. If they're negative, we wait for culture results for 6 weeks. If they're positive, we still have to do the culture and figure out what antibiotics is susceptible to. So this is a nice new process that'll be available. And lastly, I wanted to mention a brazen advertisement here that we are looking for a number of public health nurses. This is the first time in my nearly 7 years of working with the department that we have had great difficulty in recruitment. So I want to put that out publicly as far and wide as we can, that we have a number of positions, and it's very rewarding work. You don't have to handle, bedpans in the hospital, and you don't have to do a number of things in other walks of life, but you do get to play with babies in some cases, home visiting, case management for children with special health care needs. Our maternal and child health program and also our communicable disease program are all experiencing vacancies right now, and we've had a long period of vacancies and are having difficulty filling those positions. So to whatever extent our audience hears this and knows of a nurse, new grads are welcome to apply. We have ongoing recruitment going for our public health nurses. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So now the health commissioner updates. The chair has no particular update. I'm sorry. You had a question for Dr. Bornstein?
Sure. Yes, thank you. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Bornstein, since we identified after Kathleen's talk this need or this potential need for public education around heat stroke, is it possible that we could develop, we could have a presentation here that would share that information with the public? Recognizing the signs of heat stroke and how to address them.
I suppose we could, at your commission's desire, to discuss that as a prospective future agenda item. I'm not personally aware of an expert on that subject per se, but certainly we can add it to the list of interesting topics.
Potentially in the public health system.
I'm looking to Lynn, and she's looking to me.
I'm looking at.
Yeah, to try to an educational session, or even just a short understanding of what heat stroke is and how it occurs and the different level. There's heat exhaustion, heat stroke. Is that what?
Yeah,
you're referring to. Yeah, I mean, that's something I can probably do in a 5 to 10 minute. Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Raymond, did you want to put in 2 cents here?
I just wanted to add, maybe we could have someone from an ER talking about the things that they see at different, you know, heat stroke and even the CPRs, things like that that they see coming into the ERs and ways that we can help as a community.
That is always a possibility. We usually can find a friendly ER doc, or even nurses are willing to get up and stick their faces in the public once in a while. So I think we can. Oh, we have another comment from Commissioner Kingston Barker.
Dr. Bornstein, you mentioned that there was a black right now of
Hold on. What more sound?
There was a lack. Okay.
There we go.
I hit the button myself. That's great. There's a lack of public health nurses. Is it difficult to recruit to this area? There aren't enough nurses that are trained in public health. Is there something that this commission can do to assist in that? Or is there some way of, is there something that the county needs to look at doing differently in order to recruit? Because it sounds like you've got a multitude of open positions at this point.
Yeah, I know that the Economic Vitality Commission was looking at health workforce issues and the possibility of working with Cal Poly. Cuesta has an AA program, but that doesn't necessarily get you the public health credential. Yeah, it's multifactorial. We have a lot of home health, we have hospitals, we have a lot of competition. Plus, we don't have a robust production line for nurses. Plus, our cost of living is pretty high.
Yes.
For the wages. So, yeah, there's a number of considerations as to why, why recruitment is difficult. I think it was a lot better during the recession. I'm not wishing that we go back to that time, but I think the supply and demand was more in our favor. So.
Right.
Yeah, I think we'll try to continuously address it from a lot of different angles.
Okay. Thank you.
I think that goes along with the concerns that we've had over the years in terms of medical professionals altogether coming to our county. And
I think that's true, especially in specialized. When you're sitting in an area like this where you've got a high cost of living or a high cost for housing, and then you've got a trailing spouse where you're looking at two incomes, that makes it difficult to recruit. And you have some of the same challenges with physicians, too, for instance, with psychiatrists, because we talked about that before. Yeah.
So I wish there were a magic answer for that in a number of realms. Okay. Now we can move on to the commissioner reports. I'll go ahead and start with you from my right over to my left.
No,
move along.
No report.
The Behavioral Health Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board has also had the same presentation from Dr. Billig that we had last week and or last month, and they also are putting together a letter of recommendation for a behavioral health facility, and they've also been working on updating their plans over the next few years, and that will actually be presented by Ann Robin, the head of behavioral health, a week from this Tuesday at the Board of Supervisors meetings. For anybody that's interested in watching that or showing up to hear that presentation. And the Homeless Services Oversight Committee is getting ready to do their 50 Now they're going to be interviewing people, the surveys, sometime this coming up this month.
No report.
I have a couple. This morning, the Preventive Health Grant CBO committee met, and we finalized our recommendations for the grants. This year, we had about 70 applicants. They were asking for a total of $1.8 million in grant requests. We are recommending funding for 768.5 out of CBO and Preventive Health 355. And our recommendations will go before the Board of Supervisors in January, and they will accept or amend or whatever. And then the grants will be for the new fiscal year starting in July. And then additionally, the Healthy Communities Committee continues to meet monthly. Kathleen chairs that committee, which is part of the Heal Slow. It's a subcommittee of Heal Slow. And we've looked at several plans, and Jean, I believe, emailed all of us two or three plans recently. You know, one of the things that that committee does is look at proposed proposals for buildings, homes, what have you, throughout the county. We look at it from a health perspective about are there enough walking paths, what about the air control, a lot of the things that Kathleen was talking about this evening geared around climate change. And they're doing a couple of things with the Bike Coalition as well, all from a healthy perspective, and that actually is a very active little community, a committee, if you will.
I did not attend the Adult Services Policy Council meeting last Friday, but I did receive an email today about one of the speakers, and there is a free public lecture, and that's going to be held at the public library Friday, this March the 13th. And the speaker is David Smith, and he's going to be speaking on the national affordable housing changes, the demands and the funding and challenges that will affect our community. So it's, you know, if I'll give you the flyer. If anyone would want to attend, it's free, and it's at the public library, March the 13th, 2 to 3 p.m.
I am the chair of the Tobacco Control Coalition Committee, and I'm very pleased to announce that last Tuesday, the San Luis Obispo City Council voted unanimously to prohibit the use of e-cigarettes anywhere that smoking is banned, which would include most public places and workplaces, and the council is expected to give final approval on March 17th.
Terrific. Great work on that committee. No report.
Well, I attended the public forum on aging that Lois Capps put on in Buellton last month. It was surprisingly good. I thought there'd be a lot of old people complaining. And in fact, the majority of the presenters were folks like the people we've had presenting here to us, you know, have a lot of experience in the community and recognize the problems that people have. The point of this forum was to gather information for... Is that a little loud? Mm-hmm. For Representative Capps to take back to the White House for their, I think, every 10-year conference on aging. And kind of on the same theme of what we've been hearing the last 10 minutes, the a common theme was concerns about workforce as we got more and more people into the late stages of their lives needing more help, more case management, coordination, simply guiding people through the system, which is pretty difficult even for me at this stage. And then just one other thing that came up a number of times was a need to make elderly Latinos more visible to the healthcare system. So I thought it was a very productive meeting. Hopefully some of that information will get incorporated in the long-term agenda.
Well, it does sound interesting. I guess that ends our committee reports and, our commissioner reports. I don't believe any committees met over the past month. Correct me if I'm wrong. And so we're down to prospective future items on our agenda, and we did already talk about the need for public health nurses recruiting being a subject of some interest. And what else was it? I wrote down
public education.
Oh,
heat stroke.
Yeah, right. Oh, the heat. Yes, heat stroke. Heat. Were there any other thoughts? We do have upcoming programs. Jean, yeah, thank you. We had tonight, as you know, we had our program on drought and climate change, which was originally scheduled for June. So we flip-flopped, and the Children with Special Needs program will be in June. And I believe we will the April program will go ahead, the Slow Housing Trust Fund and Homeless Oversight. We'll have that for next month. Is that agreeable with the commissioners who have agreed to help put those together? And then May 11th, Commissioner Klaus was going to do a presentation on the issue.
Right, and I've done all the preliminary studies, so I'm ready to contact Cal Poly and go out and see them and talk about the opportunity to come here in May and talk to us. So I'm going to do that pretty quick, so in case they decline to do that, we'll be able to get something else for May.
Okay. I'm sure that'll be a great you'll put together a wonderful program, as you usually have done for us in the past. Any other comments on upcoming programs from commissioners? Well, I can't stretch this meeting out any longer than this, so thank you very much for being here, and stay tuned for an exciting program next month. Thank you.
Rushed out of the house, I didn't have anything.